I'm going to pull back the veil on your clergy's lives right now and tell you that there has been some, and in some cases more, angst about preaching on all these parables in Matthew. There has been indeed been some weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. The parables just keep coming, and there is a desire to find a way to speak of them in the light of what's going on in the world. And I have to say that the clergy of our shared church have done a superb job of that very thing. It is more than a little intimidating to find myself following such a batch of great homilies. But here I am. Now, even if in the factual course of events, Jesus' teaching using parables was over months and years, Matthew springs them densely together, possibly to show just how important the kingdom of heaven was to Jesus' teaching. Like your clergy, the disciples probably got a little stressed hearing him wind up with another parable and disheartedly anticipated his question, "Do you understand?" And they never did, even when he gave the most one-dimensional interpretation he could find. Surely we have some sympathy for the disciples after all these parables in a row. And yet there seems to be some urgency in Jesus. The kingdom of heaven is like this, or this, or maybe this, or this. He really wants them and us to get it, and they and we keep failing to understand. The content is familiar, but the point is elusive. I think finally, towards the end of this reading, Jesus asks if they understand, and they just say yes, just to make him stop. Take a break. Get some rest. The kingdom of heaven. Now, they might have been expecting some grand visions of streets of gold and mansions of emerald, crystal streams sparkling, peace and light, saints shining, the odd cherubim and seraphim. It's unlikely that they had a developed sense of life eternal as we've come to misunderstand it. But in a world where everything seems to be going wrong, at least the kingdom of heaven could be perfect, couldn't it? Reading these parables crammed all together tells us something different of how Jesus sees this. The kingdom of heaven, as Jesus tells us through Matthew, is very close. It's of the earth and nature, of domestic chores, the product of labor, risking all that you have, harvesting and sorting. These are mundane tasks, rarely what one would envision the kingdom of heaven to be about. Jesus uses what we might do in an ordinary day. The kingdom of heaven is like sourdough starter that only has flour and water, but is able to raise a whole loaf of bread. The kingdom of heaven is like driving on the highway and getting to your destination sooner than you thought, only to get lost in the west end of Vancouver with its one-way streets and pedestrian paths. The kingdom of heaven is like being stopped in a traffic jam and finding some time to sort through a problem with no solution. The kingdom of heaven is like people gathered for church where there is deep silence. The kingdom of heaven is mothers putting their bodies between armed police and protesters. And then the next night, the dads show up with leaf blowers to blow away the tear gas. The kingdom of heaven is hearing for the first time the voices of indigenous people who are telling what they think, and settlers finding the wisdom to listen. The kingdom of heaven is. We are so indoctrinated into the belief that heaven is that other place where sorrow and tears are no more. And maybe that's heaven too. But the kingdom of heaven that Jesus is so desperate to have us understand is something very close at hand. It's not that we suffer here so we get a great reward later. Jesus wants us as disciples to understand that it is a dimension to life that we take for granted. We pay no attention, or we discount it. And yet the kingdom of heaven intrudes on our lives, breaks through the mundane, and we glimpse the impossible or the eternal right here in the midst of us. It is just a glimpse, but in experiencing the here and now kingdom, we become more available to God in this life. And what about this upside down, topsy turvy life as it is now? How we long to go back to pre-March 15th, where we knew what to expect. We could make plans. We could depend on the basic construct of society. Church was on Sunday and we drove there. That was normal. And normal is no more. Mistakenly attributed to Brené Brown, Sonia Renee Taylor says, "We will not go back to normal. Normal never was. Our pre-corona existence was not normal, other than we normalized greed, inequity, exhaustion, depletion, extraction, disconnection, confusion, rage, hoarding, hate, and lack. We should not long to return, my friends. We have been given the opportunity to stitch a new garment, one that fits all humanity and nature." End of quote. We are in an exhausting time. Even those of us who are comfortable in all the ways that we've grown accustomed to, we tire easily, lose patience, are unfocused, obsessively double down on activities that brought us comfort in the past. And we've also ended up confronting those comforts as we become aware of what it has cost others. We haven't meant to be so blind to the struggle of Black or Indigenous or persons of color, or sexually diverse neighbors, or the environment and climate change, but there it is. Isn't it surprising, though, that in the face of pandemic, ecological disaster, etc., that we're starting to see our humanity and reach out in kinder ways? "This is not unusual," writes Rutger Bergman in his book Humankind. He documents that humans are much better than we think. One of the prevailing myths about humans is that, given a chance and all things being equal, human beings will turn on each other. It's our nature. Books like Lord of the Flies take place in our conscious and subconscious minds, and because we believe it, we live in a culture that fears our own nature. Of course, bad things happen and people do bad things. But when we are under stress, we're more inclined to not steal from each other or make living more difficult for each other. Even if we absolutely disagree with others, we know that they are being kind somewhere to somewhere else, somewhere along the line. Or at least we hope that. Bergman tells a story how in World War II, Britain's leaders were surprised and amazed that the bombing and the Blitz made the country more resilient. People cared for each other. They opened their homes. They shared the last of their food with each other. In what is a classic example of ethnocentricity, Churchill thought that this was a particularity of the British people. So he made the decision to bomb Germany in an attempt to break their spirit in turn. Well, Nazism was broken. The people themselves showed that they too were kinder under oppression. And Jesus believes this. He believes that we are capable of disclosing the kingdom of heaven in difficult, challenging moments, that we can risk all that we have for beauty, that we can trust in good things. We might also say that the kingdom of heaven is upon us now, that we are being forced to step back from the life that has become too comfortable and then be blind to the effects on others. The kingdom of heaven is when we demand fewer haircuts and more justice. What this crisis has done is to reveal the cracks in our culture that we have smoothed over. As Christians, we may even have thought of the smoothing over as the work of God. We may have identified peace with complacency. We may have thought it's okay to protest, but just don't be violent. We have been unaware that our silence can be as violent as window smashing. We haven't wanted to believe that. We have a lot of work to do. As Anglicans, our church has been built on white supremacy. We might even have written the playbook on it. Certainly, imperialism and the looting of other nations for treasures. The Anglican Church and the British Empire are inseparable in some eras of history, and we benefit from that association, even if we don't particularly like it. When we prioritize tales of the village vicar over the history of residential schools or the oppression of Africa, we're telling stories that make us comfortable. But all sides of the church need to be held together to have an honest and authentic and alive church. There was a man, Jesus said, who found a pearl of great price, and he sold all that he had to have it. I've never related to this story. I'm too cautious to sell everything I have for something, no matter how beautiful. But today I ask, am I willing to trade the bones of this church that I love for something far more rare, beautiful, and sacred? Will I be satisfied with the skeleton of holiness in the place of a whole and wild loveliness? Can the church be transformed like that mustard seed into something impossibly more? Will we worship once again, but also remember the great shadow that belongs to our church? And will we witness to its eradication? One of my favorite memes of this troubled time was this. 4 months ago, my Facebook feed was full of bread recipes. Now we're smashing white supremacy. What the beep was in that bread? Who knows where the kingdom of heaven will break down the ways of the past and move us into the future? Jesus says, therefore, every scribe who's been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like the master of the household who brings out his treasure, what is new and what is old. So, in all of this, we have even more work to do. What is our treasure of the past? What is our new treasure? Can we hold them together? We could start with one treasure and find that it just isn't fitting our new vision. What then? Or that treasure opens us up to an unexpected jewel. Do we risk it all? Do you understand?